Off the Ball Daily.
A home for your favourite podcasts from Off the Ball.
Nothing I said was wrong, so.
Okay, nothing I said was wrong is a great defence in court. Partial picture, some facts.
Partial picture and some facts, I think, would sum it up. Yeah.
Subscribe to the Off the Ball Daily podcast feed right now.
Now, every night this week, BT Sport are showing OJ, Made in America. It's a 7.5-hour documentary ostensibly about OJ Simpson, but really it's about American history and in particular the story of race in America from the civil rights movement in the 1960s all the way to today. It's obviously a particularly relevant study at the moment, given the murders of two black men by police in Baton Rouge in Minnesota and then the subsequent murder of five policemen in Dallas at a march to protest these killings. To talk to us about all this and to put some historical context on the athletes who protest is Dr. Harry Edwards, the Professor Emeritus of Sociology Department of UC Berkeley. Dr. Edwards, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been part of the leadership group of black athletes protesting all the way back to the mid to late 1960s. And with that in mind, I'm wondering, do you feel today's athletes are doing enough to be leaders of their community?
Well, I think every generation of athletes finds their own voices, finds their own space in terms of making political and culturally relevant statements. The United States is a society that is substantially built upon freedom of the speech and mass movements, and the athletes have always been part of that, going back to Jack Johnson and his insistence that he was a legitimate enough boxing prospect that he should have a shot at the heavyweight championship at a time when American white American boxers were absolutely opposed to giving blacks that opportunity. Then, of course, you have Jesse Owens and Joe Louis and their whole role in terms of the Aryan supremacist ideologies and so forth of Germany in World War II, right into the 1950s, post-World War II years with Jackie Robinson and Larry Doby and Earl Lloyd and Chuck Cooper in basketball, and, of course, Kenny Washington and Woody Strode, Marion Motley, and Bill Willis in football, all of whom were battling issues not just within the arena, but their struggles had implications beyond the arena. And then in the 1960s, of course, you had Muhammad Ali, the godfather of the movement and struggle in the 1960s, waged by athletes. You had Tommy Smith and John Carlos, Bill Russell, Jim Brown, most certainly Curt Flood, who struck a blow for freedom for professional athletes when he challenged the right of teams to move athletes around without their consent. So there's a long history of struggle, but the thing that you have to recognize is that every generation of athletes fights those struggles within the context of their own times. Today, you have athletes talking about strikes and one thing or another, some or even have even floated the notion of a boycott of the 2016 Olympics as a consequence of these killings and so forth. But their circumstances today are different than the circumstances in the 1960s. We have athletes that are literally walking corporations. And if LeBron James and Steph Curry and Serena Williams and Carmelo Anthony and some of these other great players walked into a mayor's office or a governor's office and said, we want something done about these killings, whether it's the killing of young black men and women or and children or whether it's the killing of police officers, there's no way that that governor or that mayor tells that group of athletes to get lost. We couldn't have done that in the 1960s. We didn't have that kind of power. We didn't have that kind of cachet. So every generation fights these struggles within the context of their own times, and I'm very proud of the way that these athletes today are comporting themselves and beginning to stand up and speak out.
Yeah, Carmelo Anthony just today has written a piece. I read it on the Guardian's website. I don't know where it was originally published, but it finishes with this paragraph. The teams and the support systems around athletes urge them to stay away from politics, stay away from religion, stay away from this, stay away from that. But at certain times, you've just got to put all of that aside and be a human being. That time is now.
Yes. That's a clarion call for athletes to stand up and make a statement. And when you see people such as Maya Moore, who is the MVP of the Women's NBA Professional Basketball League, and her teammates walk on the field, walk onto the court with T-shirts on saying change, you know, has to happen, a protest against the violence and the killing and the shooting. That means that athletes are finding their voices. Carmelo Anthony is absolutely correct. This generation of athletes will make its statement. It doesn't have to necessarily be a repeat of what happened in the past. It very seldom is. I mean, Muhammad Ali was not Joe Louis. Smith and Carlos was not Jesse Owens. Bill Russell was not Earl Lloyd or Chuck Cooper or the Harlem Globetrotters. Jim Brown was not Kenny Washington or Woody Strode. Kurt Flood most certainly was not Jackie Robinson. Each generation of athletes makes its own statement in its own context and its own way, and this generation of athletes will be no exception.
I want to talk a little bit about the 1965 to 1969 period and the intersection at that time of Jesse Owens and O.J. Simpson. There was a part of Jesse Owens' career which, to be honest, I was completely unfamiliar with until watching a documentary a couple of weeks ago, which you were part of, where they're talking about how he actually tries to stop the 1968 Black Power salute from Tommy Smith and John Carlos, which you were heavily involved in orchestrating. And around the same time, piecing this all together, you're also in conversations with OJ trying to convince him to become part of the movement of black athletes who are trying to organize a boycott, trying to just completely realize the power that they have to help the mass movement become even bigger. And it struck me that there's just this weird intersection between those two guys, and you're at the center of it.
Yes. Jesse Owens had a curious history. People forget that from 1966 to 1968, I mean, I was a student of sport and society. I was writing my dissertation at Cornell University on the sociology of sport, which became the first integrated textbook in what was then a new sub-discipline. I had studied Jesse Owens' history, and I found it amazing that in 1936, Jesse Owens was one of the leading black athlete voices pushing for a boycott of the 1936 games as a consequence of what Hitler and the Nazis were doing to minorities inside of Germany. And it was only after Avery Brundage went over to Germany and came back with the word that this man Hitler is all right, and what's going on over there is largely being distorted in the American media, that that effort to stage a boycott of those games was crushed. I was also aware, for example, just as another sidebar, of two Korean athletes who did a demonstration on the Olympic podium after winning first and third in the marathon. Two Korean athletes who protested the occupation of the Korean Peninsula by the Japanese. They had to perform under the Japanese flag and resented it. So those one athlete who got first blocked the rising sun flag on his uniform with the oak tree that he was given, and the other athlete who got third bowed his head and kept his hands down to his side as opposed to putting them over his heart when the Japanese national anthem was played. So I was aware of all of that history. So when Jesse Owens was sent in by the United States Olympic Committee to discourage, in point of fact, to threaten athletes who might and do anything demonstrable against racism and discrimination and the killings that were taking place of black people in American society, including the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, I found that a curious turn of events for a man who in 1936 initially was one of the forces trying to organize a boycott, athletes boycott of the 1936 Olympics. And some of the things that he said and was compelled to say were so contradictory. I mean, one of the things that he said was If you guys demonstrate or do anything that would tend to be perceived as embarrassing the United States or the United States Olympic team, you won't be able to get a job when you get back home. And I think it was John Carlos who stood up and said, Jesse, what are you talking about? I can't get a job now. So, I mean, it was the kind of thing that he was almost pressed into. And I think that ultimately he regretted it. He wrote a book, in point of fact, in 1972, titled I Have Changed, where he said something that I had never even stated, which was that in 1970, any black person who is not a militant is either naive or a coward. I mean, that was something stronger than I had ever stated about O.J. Simpson, Jesse Owens, or anybody else.
Yeah.
So I think that he changed, but there's no question that he played a convoluted kind of role in that whole process.
Well, because in his 1968 book, the previous book to that, he'd actually opened it with a quote from you calling him a bootlicking Uncle Tom. So obviously something really massive happened in his life. Some Damascene conversion, some that the scales fell from his eyes somehow, and he realized that he'd actually been somehow serving completely the wrong thing.
Oh, absolutely. And let me say something as well. You're absolutely right. He opened his book, in point of fact, his autobiography is basically an open challenge to me. Black Think is an open challenge to me and that youth movement. And he opens it, as you state, with a quote from me where I stated, Jesse Owens is a bootlicking Uncle Tom. And that is something that I regret to this day, because Jesse Owens was not an Uncle Tom, bootlicking or otherwise. Jesse Owens was afraid. America, in the America that he grew up in and the America that he came of age in, was almost institutionally committed to frightening black people, whether it be through the Ku Klux Klan, the various law enforcement agencies, the institutional structures where black humanity was demeaned and devalued. America was in the business of frightening black people. And Jesse Owens was afraid. He was afraid for this country. He was afraid for black people. He was afraid for us. And he did not understand that we were not afraid, that we had dispensed with the fear. And it was a consequence of the experiences that we had. My generation was the generation of Emmett Till. And I remember talking to my father about that lynching of Emmett Till and looking at the pictures of Emmett Till in Life magazine and in Jet magazine, his mutilated and bloated body, and asking my father, what's going to happen to the people who did this? And my father looked at me and said, absolutely nothing. My father, in my eyes at that time, when I was 12, 13 years old, was the biggest, strongest man that in my life. I thought that there was nothing that he could not do. He was 6'3 and a half, 235 pounds, with a 34-inch waist. He was a sprinter. He could run. You know, he had done time in state prison. I thought he was the biggest, baddest, toughest man in the world. And for the first time, when we were discussing Emmett Till, I saw something in his eyes that I had never seen before, and that was fear. And that was the same thing that I saw in Jesse Owens. Jesse Owens was afraid. He was afraid for us. He did not understand that we had dispensed with fear. The Emmett Till experience, we watched as four little girls were bombed in a church. We watched as Meg Evers was shot in the back. I was doing my master's thesis on the black Muslim family at Cornell in 1964, the summer and fall of 1964. And I was working with some of Malcolm X's congregation in New York City. In February of 1965, while I was actually doing that research, Malcolm X was assassinated. Martin Luther King, I met with him on January 17th, 1968. In April of 1968, he was assassinated. We were supposed to meet again on April 28th of 1968. He didn't make it. I was also working with students at San Jose State to make placards in preparation for Bobby Kennedy coming to Northern California. He was speaking in Southern California. He didn't make it. He was shot and killed in Southern California, never made it to the rallies and so forth that we had planned for Northern California. But then my 21st birthday was November the 22nd, 1963. And so I had a whole cultural and personal memory and involvement with these murders and with this violence. And so we had, me and my generation had dispensed with fear, and that was something that Jesse Owens simply did not understand, could not comprehend. While our white radical peers were talking about don't trust anybody over 30, people like me and H. Rapp Brown and Stokely Carmichael and Huey Newton and Bobby Seale and Eldridge Cleaver and Angela Davis and so forth, we didn't expect to live to be 30. So we dispensed with fear, which made us the freest people in the world to speak our mind and to do what we felt had to be done. Jesse Owens had a difficult time dealing with that. And he was not an Uncle Tom. He was afraid, and he was afraid in part for us. And if you read between the lines in his autobiography, Black Think, as much as he castigates me, in the open letter to a young Negro, that a chapter of that book that he writes to me, it becomes very, very clear that he wasn't an Uncle Tom. He was afraid in the same sense that my father was afraid for me, himself, and for black people in this country.
And something changes in the 2 years where he says he was completely wrong, and he becomes a woken person. And do you feel that you had influence in that? Because it's around this time that you start to realize the power of the athletes. It's around this time that you get to set up the movement that calls for the boycott of the 1968 Olympic Games, which ultimately doesn't happen, but it does lead to something maybe even better, which is this iconic moment in sports history where two athletes, first and third on the podium, raise their fist in the Black Power salute and they get sent home. And so maybe, you know, it becomes a much bigger story than if they hadn't been there in the first place.
Oh, absolutely. But look, again, you know, I was an Ivy League PhD student writing my dissertation, even during my activist years and my time with the Black Panther Party and organizing the Olympic Project for Human Rights. I knew the history of sports. I was aware of the two Korean athletes. I was aware of Jesse Owens' history prior to him going to the 1936 Olympic Games. I was also aware that we were not going to get a unified, uniform boycott by blacks of the 1968 Games. I mean, O.J. Simpson taught me that much in my conversations with him. He did not want to exchange white racism for black orthodoxy, black power, or any other form of ideological orthodoxy that might have been on the scene at that time. O.J. Simpson wanted to be judged completely by the content of his character and the caliber of his competence. He did not feel any more obligation to step up and stand up for black people, despite the fact that he was standing on the shoulders of those who had sacrificed before him. He felt he should have no more obligation to stand up for black people than Larry Bird should have to stand up for poor whites in Appalachia and French Lick, Indiana. He just didn't feel that obligation. And so automatically I knew that that was a parallel path, a parallel universe of black commitment that was moving right alongside the new militancy among athletes. So I never expected that we would have a unified, uniform boycott of the games. I knew that the historically black institutions, which is still where at that time many of the great black athletes, the Ralph Bostons, the Bob Beamons, and others, the Jim Hines out of Texas Southern, those black schools were where many of these athletes came from, and there were coaches and people in those institutions who made it very clear any athlete who even advocated, much less participated in any Olympic Project for Human Rights activities, would be dismissed from school, not just from the Olympic team, but from school, because There was no way that these schools could go to these white legislators upon whom they were dependent for their funding and explain how athletes coming out of those programs at those schools were advocating a boycott of the 1968 Olympic Games. And so we knew that we were not going to have the athletes from the historically black schools, which were who were most of the athletes participating in the games on behalf of the United States. We also knew that there were athletes like Charlie Green and Mel Tinder who were in the military and who were literally participating and preparing for the Olympic Games under orders. They were not going to boycott the games. So from the outset, I was aware of the history of the games. I was aware of the demonstrations that took place at the, on the podium at the games. I was aware that Avery Brundage, who was head of the United States Olympic Committee in 1936, had removed Jews from the American track team and replaced them with Ralph Metcalf and Jesse Owens because he was afraid not of offending the sensibilities of Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler had ceased to participate, to attend the games by the time the relays were run. He had removed them because he was afraid that they would stage some demonstration on the podium during the 1936 Olympic Games. I was aware of all of that history. So in pushing for a boycott, what I did was to create a universe of thought that enabled us to move forward with other options and also provided some cover for those athletes who were simply trying to make the team with some prospect of demonstrating once they got there, as had been the case in 1936. And so when people were saying after all of the athletes had qualified and were on the plane on the way to Mexico City and so forth, well, Dr. Edwards, are you calling off the boycott? Is the boycott over? I made the statement straight out. There are many, many ways to boycott. No, I am not calling the movement off. I am not calling the boycott off because I understood the prospects for other things developing because they had already developed at the 1936 games, even though they were not noted. They were mostly forgotten history, but that reality was there. And so I think that Jesse Owens, looking back over his own history and understanding some of my writings and what happened in 1968, had a change of heart in terms of his whole disposition toward that movement. I think also Jesse Owens' children and grandchildren made it clear that he had to take another look at the stance that he had taken relative to the black athletes in 1968.
A change of heart which restores his place in American black sports history as a hero, I suspect, in a way that there will never be a rehabilitation for O.J. Simpson. Is that fair?
Well, Jesse Owens doesn't need to have his position restored. Jesse Owens was a victim of the system that we were fighting against. We understood that in our rhetoric and the urgency that we felt of the moment, in our anticipation that perhaps we would not be around to make other statements, given the rates at which black militant youth in this country was under attack in the late 1960s, the murder of Mark Clark and Fred Hampton, the shootings of Black Panthers across the country, the fact that over 3,000 black Americans lost their lives from 1954 when Brown versus Board of Education, Topeka, Kansas, edict came out of the Supreme Court integrating schools and removing separate but equal as the law of the land, up through the assassination of Dr. King, over 3,000 black people lost their lives in this country. We didn't expect to be around to make corrective assessments and statements later. So our rhetoric soared. Our condemnation of those who confronted and opposed what we knew to be the truth soared. And so, but Jesse Owens doesn't need to be rehabilitated in terms of his place in the pantheon of great American athletes. That situation was safe. What he has done is pretty much the same thing that Muhammad Ali did, change course and say, this is where we should be headed, and I was wrong. That in and of itself is commendable. O.J. Simpson has never been about anything but O.J. Simpson. And now that he's in the straits that he's in, that's what he has to fall back on. Unfortunately, there was never anything there of commendable substance, and that's what he's left with. I do not put O.J. Simpson in the same category as Jesse Owens. I do not put O.J. Simpson in the same category as Jim Brown or of any of the other great athletes who, even when they were not totally correct, they were trying to do and say something of substance beyond the box scores and what their athletic prowess brought to them in terms of financial and other rewards.
The conversation that you had with OJ trying to recruit him to be part of the movements, was that a straightforward conversation? Did he entertain it at any point? Did he think about, actually, you know what, maybe there is something here for me? Or was it straight out, I'm not interested, I'm not black, I'm OJ, was the quote that everybody keeps coming back to.
It was straight up. It was straightforward. But I was not the first one to try to have this conversation with OJ. Jim Brown tried to have that conversation with OJ. OJ was the biggest collegiate sports name in the country for 2 years. His 2 years at USC were stellar. Here you had a handsome, articulate, profoundly gifted athlete, black athlete, who had absolutely no consciousness in terms of any broader obligation. Even as Dr. Martin Luther King was shot down, even as black people were being washed down the street with fire hoses like basketballs, even as dogs were being sicked on grandmamas and eight-year-old girls who were out marching in support of the right of African Americans to vote, O.J. Simpson had absolutely nothing to say about that because he feared it would somehow impact his endorsement and monetary options, and that was the path that he consciously chose. I wasn't the only one to approach O.J. Simpson. Jim Brown, a number of other people approached O.J. Simpson, and he made it very, very clear that he was not black. I'm O.J. I don't identify with being black. I'm O.J., and that is a marketable brand, and that is what I am seeking to protect. And that's fine. That's good. I can understand a person making that choice. And O.J. was straight up and honest about it. And I don't hold that against him. But don't then turn around and play the race card when you're caught up in a double murder. And now all of a sudden you're going to become a victim of your blackness and being black in America. I mean, I don't want to hear that. I mean, that's worse than contradictory. That's duplicitous to the point of almost being evil.
What's the fallout from the O.J. Simpson trial? Because watching the documentary over the last week, it's just airing at the moment here in Ireland, you know, you can't but be struck that it seems like there are a lot of lessons to be learned. I'm just not quite sure if I can grasp that anything specific has changed from the 1950s, the 1960s to last week.
Nothing. A great deal has changed. What is in question is how much progress has been made. You can't look at an African-American family in the White House and say that nothing has changed. You can't look at the numbers of black elected officials in America and say that nothing has changed. You can't look at a black police chief that is honored and loved and respected in Dallas Texas and say that nothing has changed. What is in question is how much progress has been made. And what the O.J. Simpson trial brought to the surface was the tremendous divisions and so forth that persist in American society, because we have failed to deal with what is America's original sin. There's this silly notion in America that it's that the American original sin was slavery. That's ridiculous, because slavery came about as a consequence of what the real original sin was, which was a virulent, violent, deep-rooted white supremacy that still persists in American society. This is an issue that we have simply been unwilling to talk about in an honest, straightforward fashion. White supremacy is still the preeminent cultural strain of identity and power in American society. O.J. Simpson's trial brought that out. It wasn't that black people believed that O.J. Simpson was not guilty, in the same sense that they did not believe that the police who murdered Mike Brown were not guilty, or the guy that killed Trayvon Martin was not guilty, but they all walked. And in many instances, black people looked at the O.J. Simpson situation and said, this is one for our side, and O.J. walked instead of being found guilty. So when we look at the issue of the O.J. Simpson trial, it comes down to one question: what constitutes progress in terms of this issue of race in American society? And for better and for worse, progress is one of those concepts that's a lot like profit. At some point, it comes down to who's keeping the books. And we had gotten to the place in American society that a lot of white America used O.J. Simpson as the measure of how much progress we had made in the area of race relations. He had endorsements, he had fame, he had fortune, he had recognition, and the only thing that they asked of O.J. Simpson was that he leave his blackness, his black culture, his black identity behind. Do not walk into the room with that, and we will give you riches beyond your greatest dreams, which is what they did until those two white corpses showed up on the doorstep of his wife's condo, his ex-wife's condo. And so O.J. Simpson opened up that whole discussion of race and how much progress had actually been made, and in point of fact, how we define progress. An African-American family in the White House opened up those same kinds of questions. America today is as divided as it ever was because we have not dealt with the central contradiction of American life going back to the time that black people were defined as three-fifths of a human being in this society. And that question is the question of white supremacy.
It's a question that I can't see being answered anytime soon either.
No, it's not going to be answered finally anytime soon. It may never be answered finally, because America is always and always has been a work in progress. And it's going to come down to we, the people, what we, the people down here on the ground, decide to do. That's the message that came out of Dallas this week. The United States Constitution begins with the line, we the people, in order to form a more perfect union. It doesn't say we the presidents, or we the governors, or we the courts, or we the law enforcement establishment, or we the nonprofits or corporations. It says we the people, and that is an ongoing struggle. In American society, the challenges that we face in terms of achieving that more perfect union are dynamic and diverse, the struggle to bring about that achievement, therefore, is multifaceted and perpetual, and there are no final victories. We may never arrive at that shining city on the hill that America promises. We may never achieve a perfect union, but we can always struggle toward achieving that more perfect union. And so the idea that somehow we're going to arrive at a post-racial America is nonsense. The idea that somehow we're going to arrive at a point where in this diverse society of immigrants, natives, and ex-slaves, we're going to somehow eliminate all problems of diversity is a pipe dream. But what is important is that the struggle continues. And I think that at its foundation, that is what America is about. That is what America offers the rest of the world, that despite our imperfections, look at what we have been able to achieve together. And most importantly, that struggle continues.
Well, Dr. Edwards, you've certainly done your bit for the struggle. Thanks so much for sharing your thoughts with us here in Ireland this evening, and thanks so much for making so much time for us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, and I hope that it's been worth your time.